So we won the evangelicals. We won with young. We won with old. We won with highly educated. We won with poorly educated. I love the poorly educated. We're the smartest people. We're the most loyal people.
Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Arnold says, I'm waiting for him to tweet out the nuclear launch codes. He's just so waiting to get to the Twitters. And again, I go back to the Comey testimony, his bit on the 27th at the dinner at the White House. He writes, the president began by asking me whether I wanted to stay on as FBI director, which I found strange, because he had already told me twice in earlier conversations that he'd hoped I would stay, and I had assured him that I intended to. A few minutes later, the president said, I need loyalty. I expect loyalty. I didn't move, speak, or change my facial expression in any way during the awkward silence that followed. We simply looked at each other in silence. And again, I go back to that, the 15-year-old beauty queen. This is that scenario. Sad, scary stuff. But the thing is, and this is the scary stuff, look at, in such a short period of time, how much our country has been transformed and not for the better. And here to talk about the big hearing and where we're going, I've asked Dr. Wilmer Leon to come talk with us. He's host of SiriusXM's Inside the Issues, also a nationally syndicated columnist. Dr. Leon, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick, thanks so much for having me this morning. How are you?
I'm not good. You know, I'm looking at this display. I'm looking at all of this distraction, and I'm thinking about all of the things that we're not doing as a nation, like educating our children, getting health care for people, improving our infrastructure. I'm just, while I'm enjoying the spectacle, I'm concerned about the future of this country.
Well, it's interesting that you make that point, because I'm finishing an op-ed right now, which should be out tomorrow, called JFK's New Frontier versus Trump's America the Usual. And the point of the piece, as we just on the 29th of May, commemorated the 100th birthday of the late President Kennedy, I went through and looked at some of his initiatives, and raising the minimum wage and Medicare, increasing Social Security benefits. He provided federal aid to cities to improve housing and transportation. And then I'm contrasting that to Trump's budget, and it's despicable, it's deplorable, and so much of this seems to be related to what President Eisenhower warned us about, which was the confluence of interest between the military, government, and corporatists as we look at the military-industrial complex.
Yeah, and now turning into the educational military-industrial complex. And it's an interesting frame that you've made, because you go from ask not what your country can do for you to what you can do for your country to screw you guys, more for me.
Exactly. And then you add to that, as you just talked about education, now Trump is talking about privatizing airports, privatizing the FAA. Just when you think that there is something that still should be sacred, you find that honestly, there in his mind, there isn't.
Oh, but here's the thing, Doctor, and this is the weird part of this, is, I don't see anything that Trump has done or wants to do as anything outside of the Republican mainstream thought. This idea of privatizing every function of government has been a core central tenet of the GOP for at least a couple of decades now.
There's no question about that, that privatization has been at the key of Republican efforts for a very long time. Now, we can't let Democrats off the hook.
Nope.
Bill Clinton charged Al Gore with reinventing government as we know it.
Yeah.
Trying to now
And that meant breaking unions and privatizing and all of that stuff. So just wanted to throw that in there.
We had to throw that in there. And then we also have to remember that President Obama also, in some regards, was more George Bush than George Bush, particularly when it comes to the national security state. So it we can't paint this picture as though it's binary. But to your point, the privatization of this country has been the focal point of Republican policy. And then we also have to throw into that how racism has been used to sell this as well.
Oh yeah, absolutely. But yeah, but here's the thing: as a labor guy, and I say that all the time. You know, I'm a union guy, and I look at labor's history. It's always been, how do we pit people against each other? White collar, blue collar, black, white, men, women. It didn't matter. Any way the wealth class of this country can pit people against each other so that they're infighting amongst themselves and not looking to them is good in their view.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Controlled chaos to a great degree. And we can take this all the way back to the end of slavery, and how poor white farmers were convinced that they should not form any type of alliance or allegiance with newly freed slaves, that even though they were poor white farmers, they were white.
Right.
And that because what a lot of people don't remember about that time in history is newly freed slaves and poor white farmers were actually starting to coalesce. They were starting to work together and champion their interests as laborers. And the corporate interests in this country quickly understood that that was a coalition that absolutely under no circumstances would be allowed to stand. And so the construct of racism, or the construct of race, was injected into that dynamic and drove a huge division, caused a huge schism between poor white farmers and newly freed slaves.
Right. You know, a couple years ago, we had done a civil rights tour with the program, and we went to Durham, North Carolina, to historic Stagville. And if you ever get a chance, you're ever in Durham, it is a great tour. But it was a former plantation that they've turned into a tourist attraction, to where you can go see the slave quarters, and they give a fantastic tour. And the woman, you know, took us to one of the slave quarters, which was very well built and I'm not going to say nice, but it was much better than what the white farmers across the fence were sleeping in. And, you know, she made that exact point. You know, in this instance, the slaves had actually better living conditions than the white farmers did. But at least, you know, the white farmers thought, well, we're at least not them.
Exactly. Exactly. And it's important to me, and I drive this point home to some ad nauseum. But it's important to understand that race is an artificial construct. It does not exist. But it was created in this country in order to accomplish many of the very things that you're articulating.
Right. But don't you think, Doctor, that, you know, it does, even if we were all a cocoa brown color, they would figure out a way to pit us against each other, maybe on eye color or hairstyle or shoe size or something?
Well, yes, but the phenotypical distinctions are so powerful and prevalent that I don't know that other tactics would be as successful, and I don't know that other tactics would have endured to the degree that the artificial racial construct has. Because it's very simple to pit, I mean, that's a very simple binary white-black issue.
Right. No, I get it. You know, look, I grew up in a housing project in the west side of Cleveland, one of the very few white kids in an all-black neighborhood. We used to play this neat game called Chase the White Kid and Beat Him Up. I'm sure it was a fun game. But, you know, early on, I learned that the only color that really mattered was green, because we were all poor. At the end of the month, we all didn't have food. At the end of the month, we were all struggling, and we all didn't have money. So to me, it was very clear that it was an economic thing more than it was a black-white thing.
it was an economic thing and we have to understand, yes, that poverty and economics is a very, very powerful element in the division within this country. But just as you just said, one of the fun games that was played in the neighborhood was chase and beat up the white kid. So even within that that impoverished setting, the race dynamic still found itself to be a real problem, unfortunately, for you.
Yeah. No, but do you think, and look, I don't really know, but do you think that we naturally seek out differences just to divide ourselves on a certain level?
Well, I do believe in the adage that birds of a feather flock together.
Okay.
But I think we have to then draw distinctions between, once the birds of a feather have coalesced, what is the result of that gathering, and do they then turn towards those that are unlike them, or do they turn against those that are unlike them?
And I think that's an important question, because we're living at a time right now where the political power is in the hands of people who want to pit us against one another. And right now it's immigrants and it's people of color. What will it be tomorrow? I don't know. But, you know, this is really central to what's going on today, I think.
It is really central to what is going on today. And there's a fantastic book by an economist, Guy Standing. It's called The Precariat: The New Dangerous Class, and where he's talking about looking at this economically and looking at, there's this new group of economically impoverished people that are working three and four jobs just to remain poor, and that their situation is so tenuous and so precarious that they are now what is being called the precariat class. And this is a very, very, very dangerous development within the economy in this country and the world economy overall.
Right. And that's only going to get worse as we continue to automate and continue to pursue trade deals that put us in competition with desperate nations.
Well, yes, but that then takes me to Dr. King's comments and observations about the threat of militarism and capitalism. And it's understanding that we're losing jobs due to automation, but when we are taking our limited tax dollars and wasting them on rebuilding a military to fight a battle that really doesn't exist, at the expense of our schools, at the expense of our bridges, at the expense of our teachers' salaries, and our highways, we're creating the mess through because budgets are numeric representations of priority.
Right, it's a moral document.
It there you go, spelled out in numbers and commas and zeros. And so we can look at this budget proposed by Donald Trump, and we can see exactly whose interests are being represented, whose interests are being protected, and who are the people or the class or groups of people that they don't give a damn about.
Right, but here's the thing, Doctor. I mean, and look, I talked about this all during the campaign leading up to this. We knew these were his priorities. We knew that this is what the wealth class does. We know this is what the Republican Party is. I mean, if you read the Republican Party's platform, look, I'll defend him. He was honest. He said he was going to do what he did, and he's doing it. Now, they're going to repeal and replace Obamacare. Did he say 24 million or 23 million people are going to be without care? No, didn't care about those people.
But a couple of things to that point. First of all, you're right. But I think you also have to factor into that at the beginning of the election, at the beginning of the process, mainstream media treated Donald Trump as a joke.
Yes.
They didn't take him seriously. He could call into just about any national news program he wanted to. He could talk for as long as he wanted to. He could say what he wanted to, because they basically saw him as comic relief.
Oh, no, they saw him as dollar signs.
Well, that too. Oh, that too. No question that it wasn't Roger Ailes. It was the president of NBC that said that he's great for ratings.
Yep.
So we take that. Then I know you had Greg Palast on yesterday. I think you had Greg on yesterday.
Yep, good man.
Yeah. So you then factor in a couple of things. One, Donald Trump did not win the popular vote. He lost by 3 million votes. So this populism that is being discussed, we could argue whether or not, or does he have a mandate? Yes, he won the Electoral College, but he did lose the popular vote by 3 million votes. And then you take Greg's research and see that if it hadn't been for the cross-check program, Chris Kobach and the Republicans, that the election was basically stolen.
No, I've been saying this. I've been saying this. For weeks now, or actually for months, that all of this Russian stuff is important. I want to know what meddling. I want to know how deep it goes. But the ultimate theft was what was brought on by the Republican Party, who for years have been pursuing policies and obstacles to the voting box. I look here in Pennsylvania. They passed a voter ID law where the state admitted that what they passed would have never stopped anyone from would have never stopped a crime. They had never found a crime. They had never found anyone who had done it. They admitted it, but it was the right thing to do because no one knows why.
Before we pay attention to the Kremlin, and before we pay attention to the Russians, we have to focus on Kobach and the Republicans.
Yep.
That was the damage to our electoral process. Don't worry about Vladimir Putin. He's doing basically what the United States has done in elections around the world for who knows how long. It what put Donald Trump in the White House was Chris Kobach, the cross-check program, and the Republican Party. And now Donald Trump is putting Kobach in charge of the voting commission so that he can then validate the machinations that they're going through to disenfranchise poor people of color and elderly people in this country.
And let's not forget students as well, because look, those are the people. Those are the people who are going to be, looking for more progressive policies to help them out. But here at the end of this, it comes back to us. It's our fault. And this has been a fundamental shift in this country, I believe, because the right wing has built what I think is a masterful echo chamber that has created a society of people who believe that they're victims and that it's the poor people who are victimizing them.
I can't debate that with you in the least. A clear recent example of that would be Ben Carson's comment that poverty is a state of mind. Some people dismiss that as the rantings of a lunatic. What you really have to understand, not you because I know you do, what people really have to understand is that is part of a narrative of blaming of that conservatives love to employ, which is blaming the poor for their plight.
Yep.
You're poor because you don't work hard enough. You're poor because you didn't spend enough time in school. You're poor because you just think you are. You have this state of mind. If you just changed your mind, you could change your financial circumstance, ignoring the fact of deindustrialization in this country, ignoring the fact of disinvestment in our public school system, ignoring the other hard realities of government disinvestment in the core support elements that are important so that all boats can rise with the rising tide.
It's incredible stuff. You know, and again, you go back to all of the things that destroyed that healthy middle class that my grandparents' generation built. It comes down to all of that, our bad trade policies, the union busting that's been allowed to go on, and all the disinvestment. And I bring most of it back to Reagan, but it started a little bit before that. The idea that, you know, the ketchup is a vegetable guy. You know, yes. The fact that we're going to take literally, and people were okay with literally taking food out of the mouths of children to give tax breaks to the very wealthy is not a new thing. It's just something that we're no longer ashamed of, I think.
It's something that we're no longer ashamed of, and I would add to that, it's also something, the degree to which we have not seen it at to such a degree, at such a rapid pace, and just so blatantly and patently obvious, and nobody really seems to care that the 400 wealthiest families in this country control, 400 wealthiest families, I think, in the world control 99% of the wealth in this country.
There's something seriously wrong with that. And yet we keep hearing, Dr. Leon, that we need more tax cuts, that we need to double down on voodoo Reaganomics, that the rich people, if we give them all the money, something eventually has to fall out of their pockets that we can scurry for.
Well, and see, that goes to what we were talking about earlier. That gets to a very fundamental element about or argument, which has been the argument since the founding of the country: what is the job of government? And that, again, takes us back to this dichotomy between John Kennedy and his New Frontier program and Lyndon Johnson's Great Society and where we are now with Trump's budget.
Right.
And so if we all understand that the one of the primary elements of government is to take care of those in this country, as opposed to this individualism that so many of us have been convinced of.
Right.
Individual self-realization, and if you just work harder, you will do well for yourself, not really caring about the collective and understanding that when everyone is doing better, we all do better.
Right. Everyone's doing better when everyone does better. But, you know, here's the thing. What we've been told for so long is we can all be that Horatio Alger character, you know, pull ourselves up by the bootstraps and the self-made man and all of those myths that we've been sold. You know, it's always been my view that what I want government to do are the things that I individually can't do. Build roads, educate the youth, defend the country, end poverty, end homelessness. You know, things that I individually cannot do, but I think we should be doing as a society. That's what government should be doing.
That's what government should be doing. But what the prominent narrative now is, of course, it's all about individualism. It's all about self-actualization. It's gone away from we the people to me and a few other guys.
Yeah, and the heck with the rest of you. Now, look, I'm all in favor of, you know, I want to do as well as I can do, and I want the next guy to do as well as he can do and all of that. But there's something wrong when you have a handful of people who control more wealth than the vast majority of the nation. When you have one family who controls more wealth than almost half of the country, there's a problem with that.
There's a problem with that. The framers of the Constitution even understood that there was a problem with that. Thomas Jefferson and the others understood that if you have a vast disparity in wealth, that what you will do is you will sow the seeds of discontent amongst your general populace, and that they will revolt against the powers that be. And again, you have to add to that, particularly in the current, well, it's been an ongoing narrative, but it's just been more blatant with starting with Ronald Reagan and his welfare queen and all of that kind of stuff, and now what Trump is talking about, when you inject xenophobia and you inject bigotry and racism into that narrative, so now you have these bands of crazy Mexicans that are coming over the border to rape and pillage and take our jobs, and there's a Muslim behind every rock that's looking to blow you up. When you also then play into and fan the flames of that narrative, it becomes increasingly easier to sell this foolishness to a broader cross section of the American population.
Yeah, boy. I mean, you go to the bottom of Maslow's hierarchy. What's at the bottom? That's where they play. They
exactly.
You know, they hang out in the bottom.
No question. Because that's the least common denominator.
Yep.
And that's the simplest thing. That's the simplest thing to play to, as you talked about the Maslow's hierarchy of needs.
Yeah.
That is the simplest thing to play to.
Hate and fear plays well. So, last question I've got for you, and it's really been—I've really enjoyed our conversation. What do we do with all of this? I mean, it's one thing to say we know all of this. How do you fix it? Because look, I mean, our country is in turmoil right now. We've got some really serious problems, outside of what's going on the screen right now. What are we suggesting?
Well, first of all, people have to read. People that are listening to you are obviously some fairly intelligent people, and they've got to read. That's the first thing, so that they can start to identify the inconsistencies and the hypocrisy in terms of what they're being told, and they can't give up on the process. One of the points that you made earlier is that we as a people, we have relinquished our obligation as citizens, and we're now just leaving it up to our elected representatives. Some of this sounds trite, and some of this sounds simplistic, but I honestly believe that we can retake control of this country. We first have to take control of our own living rooms, and then once we've taken control of our own living rooms, we can go out and take control of our front yards, and from that point, we can take control of our neighborhood.
There you go. As I always say, if you want to change the world, start with your little piece of it.
Hey, there you go, and it'll spread like Topsy.
There you go. That's it. Dr. Wilmer Leon, I appreciate you taking time for us. Great talk with you. I'd love to have you back again sometime real soon.
Anytime. And let me just tell folks quickly, the book is Politics, Another Perspective, and they can go to wilmerleon.com to get a copy of the book.
And we'll make sure we get a link at thericksmithshow.com so folks can
Thanks,
do that.
Man.
Thanks so much.
Right.
Appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Great talking with you. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.